They call him Sunshine, Professor Sunshine. He'll educate you in history, from the Reformation to the wealth of nations.
What? You don't like it? Get your own podcast. Stay tuned for the Apologetics Minion. Welcome to the Apologetics Minion Show. I'm your host, Daniel Wynn. The mission of the Apologetics Minion Show is to follow Jesus with all my mind and encourage others to do the same, thinking carefully about the Christian worldview. Welcome back to the show. You either really liked me from the last show, or you just are a glutton for punishment. Either way, thanks for joining me. We have a special show today. We have a in-studio guest, Dr. Glenn Sunshine, professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. He'll be joining us in a little bit to talk about his books, as well as his activities with the Colson Fellows, formerly known as the Centurions Program. But first, let's hear from Tim Hull from Ratio Christi.
I am Tim Hall, the Everyday Apologist, here to get you thinking. Is there a conflict between faith and reason? The atheists would like us to think so. They might say that if there is a free, omniscient being out there pulling all the strings, there would be complete chaos. And we don't see chaos, we see order. But if God created us in His image, and reason is a part of His image, then we should be able to have access to that reason. And if we would correctly use it, we should be able to come to conclusions about all things. Maybe not complete and full conclusions, but satisfactory ones that are consistent with the truth. We should be able to reason through things like how this world works, some knowledge about its creator, and how best to live within it. So I see no conflict between faith and reason. I am Tim Hall with Ratio Christi. For more information, please text WCTL to 313131 or visit EverydayApologist.com.
I love that bumper music, huh? Okay, we're back. And as promised, we have our special guest in studio today, Professor Glenn Sunshine. He's a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thanks for having me.
So, Glenn, we would like to talk about your book, which is, wow, I'm drawing a blank on it. Oh, yeah, Why You Think the Way You Do. Maybe you should write a follow-up to that, Why You Forget Why You Thought the Way You Did. So tell us about your book.
Well, the book is essentially a history of Western civilization done through the lens of changing worldviews. Your worldview is the basic assumptions you make about the world and your place in it. And everybody has a worldview, but not only individuals do, cultures do as well. So as worldviews change, cultures change with them, because culture is basically built around a set of core ideas. So what I did is I looked at Western civilization, starting with the Roman Empire and bringing it up to the present, looked at what the worldviews were, how they changed, and what the impact of that was on society.
So what is it that had the greatest influence on Western civilization?
Well, when you start off with the Roman Empire, you have a world that's really, really different from what we saw since then. And really, the thing that transforms it is Christianity. Because Christianity isn't only a religion, it's a worldview. It gives you a comprehensive way, complete way, of looking at all of reality. And as the Christian ideas infiltrated the culture, as they developed over time, and it always takes time, none of this stuff happens instantly, as the full implications of what Christianity said about, say, human nature and things like that were worked out over time, it led to massive changes in the culture.
And could you give some examples? I mean, what did it actually look like, say, before and after?
Well, let's just take the idea of human rights, for example. There is no culture in the world, no religion in the world, nobody, aside from Judaism and Christianity, that created the concept of universal human rights. Within the Roman Empire, your rights were determined entirely by your status. If you were a free person, you had one set of rights. If you were a slave, you had a different set of rights. If you were in the nobility, you had a different set of rights, and so on. And that's because of some fundamental assumptions they made about the nature of well, the world in general, but human society in particular, it's fundamentally hierarchical. There are some people who are superior and others that are inferior. The superiors rule, the inferiors serve.
So in other words, everybody's created equal, but some were more equal than others.
Absolutely not. People were not created equal. According to Aristotle, a slave was, and I quote, a living tool. That's really, really kind of different from saying, you know, the slave is fundamentally equal to the noble or to the king or even to a free man.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't, say, the Old Testament law have different sets of rules for, say, the Israelites and a different, another set of rules for the alien living among them, and even a different set altogether for the people they were to drive out from the Promised Land?
Well, yeah, there are differences between all of those, and we could look at those in detail. But let's take a look, for example, at the issue of slavery. That might be the best place to start as an illustration.
That does seem to be the hot-button issue. You hear a lot of skeptics object that the Bible seems to actually condone slavery. Is that the case?
Yes and no. It all depends in a lot of ways on what you mean by slavery and how you understand it. If you look in the Old Testament, for example, the institution of slavery existed within Israel, but it served a really different function from what we normally think of. Basically, the situation in Israel was that if a person became got into trouble, was bankrupt, couldn't keep his family alive. And when we're talking bankruptcy, we literally mean people who are starving and cannot feed their family. They had the option of selling themselves into slavery to a wealthier neighbor. That neighbor would take them in, would feed them, and in return for this, they would work for them for a certain number of years, after which they would be set free.
So basically, this was the ancient world's safety net.
Precisely. That is actually, throughout the ancient world, that was a common approach to taking care of the poor, although Israel is the only nation that I know of that had the provision where they would be set free after a certain number of years.
Now, was that the same case for, say, foreigners or prisoners of war?
No, there were different rules for foreigners and prisoners of war. There's some indication, by the way, that slaves who were brought into Israel were to be set free when they got inside the boundaries. But the law does allow foreigners to be owned outright in a way that Israelites themselves aren't. But even there, there are a number of restrictions on how slaves could be treated, and if they were mistreated, they would be automatically freed.
So they weren't automatically treated as property, say, along the lines of antebellum slavery in the United States in the 19th century.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. The Old Testament does describe them as property, but it's curious that in those contexts you discover that they're property with rights.
Well, imagine if your car was like that. You know, it's like you want to drive somewhere, and the car is just like, excuse me, I have the right to stop now, which could be really inconvenient. But we're not talking about the same thing now, are we?
No, there was no law in Israel, for example, against you burning down your house if you wanted to do it, or against smashing up your own stuff. However, if you caused a permanent injury, knocked a tooth out, broke an arm or something like that on your slave, that slave was automatically freed.
So if you would think of it in terms of property, it'd be almost like, if you got in a car fender bender, you forfeited your car. Except, again, cars aren't people. People are actually valuable in and of themselves.
Exactly. And this, especially when we get into the New Testament, this is going to be a subversive idea, this idea of the equality of all people, which we'll talk about more, I guess, after the break. But this idea of the equality of all people becomes a sort of subversive idea that ends up undermining the entire Roman social structure, and with it creating the first, you know, really completely free society in human history.
Yes, there is some question about if there's a difference between how the Old Testament treated slavery and how the New Testament did. And when we come back from the break, I want to get into that a little bit, and then how that impacted Roman society and Western civilization in general. So we'll come back after this break and this message about Ratio Christi. When confronted with intellectual challenges to Christianity, many Christian college students will abandon their faith. Secular thought dominates most educational institutions. Christian students are often ridiculed and openly humiliated by fellow students and faculty for believing in God, the Bible, and Jesus Christ. Evangelism has declined as a post-Christian culture dominates and believers do not have the answers to important questions. Ratio Christi, a Campus Apologetics Alliance, places Christian apologetics clubs at secular, liberal, religious, public, and private universities around the world in order to take part in the battle for the mind and begin to reverse the humanist trend of thought by providing and equipping students with the answers or means of getting the answers to the pressing questions of life that shape our worldview. For more information on Ratio Christi, go to www.ratiochristi.org. That's RATIOCHRISTI.ORG.
I like that music, huh? And we're back. When we left off before the break, we were talking about the impact of Christianity on Western civilization and how it affects things such as our view of human rights and slavery. And so we're picking up. So we talked about slavery in the Old Testament and how it was different from the forms that we're more familiar with in antebellum South in the United States in the 19th century. So pick it up from there. Now, how does the New Testament see things any differently or the same?
Well, in the New Testament era, there are a couple of things that are going on. First of all, we do need to acknowledge right up front that the Apostle Paul seems to allow for slavery. He gives instructions for how masters are to treat slaves, slaves are to act toward their masters, and so on. So we have to acknowledge that the New Testament is written in a context in which slavery existed. There were slaves that were in churches. There were people who owned slaves in churches, and so on. However, having said that, we need to take a closer look at what the New Testament actually says about slavery in order to really understand what's going on there.
Now, before we do that, I think it's important to note, and correct me if I'm wrong, but much of the Old Testament law was written to a nation, telling them how to be a nation. Contrasted to that, the New Testament was written to individuals and communities of faith about how to be individuals and communities of faith following Christ. So basically, there was really not an intention of the New Testament to tell a nation how to be a nation. It was really how to tell Christians and churches how to be Christians and churches in the nations that they were. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, I think so. The Old Testament is written for a single ethnic nation to provide a foundation for the law, the law code within that particular kingdom. In the New Testament, in the New Covenant, things get kind of blown up. It's no longer limited to a single nation. It becomes internationalized. And that's actually one of the reasons why a lot of the specific laws in the Old Testament drop out, because they were written to provide a national law, and yet the covenant people was now no longer a specific nation. It was international. So that's one of the main differences between the New Covenant and the Old Covenant. There is no national law. There's no need for it because it's no longer a covenant for a specific nation. That's not to say that the civil laws are unimportant. There's a lot that we can learn from them, but we don't have to apply them rigidly or directly. Instead, what we should do is look at the principles that underlie them and try to figure out how those might inform the way we do law and justice today.
So given that difference, we shouldn't really expect to see slavery addressed as an issue, given that you don't find a lot in the New Testament about, okay, go and make this law or go and conduct your nation that way because it just simply isn't intended that way.
Well, that's correct, but I would take it a step further. The Romans were very, very much aware of the dangers of slave rebellions. And in fact, they had several of those, which they put down with their characteristic brutality and violence. Lots of people dead. The most famous of these, of course, was Spartacus, but there were others as well. Now, I want you to imagine what would happen if the authors of the New Testament started saying things like, all slaves should be free.
That would be chaos, now, wouldn't it? I mean, one of the things we have to keep in mind also, given the complete lack of a social safety net, it's not like there was a ready job market where people could just switch careers from, okay, my resume up to this point was slave. Oh, I think I'll go be a widget maker or something. They didn't work that way, did it?
No, the entire economy was built around the idea of slavery. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And this is true not only of Rome, but of pretty much everywhere else in the ancient world. A very, very few exceptions to that. So what happens is, in the New Testament, you're in a situation where I think it's pretty clear that they reject the fundamental ideas that are behind slavery. In other words, that slaves are intrinsically inferior and all of those sorts of things. We see Paul saying that in Christ there's no slave nor free. The idea is that all people are spiritually and morally equal before God. They are all in need of salvation, and they all obtain salvation exactly the same way. So there is this kind of equality there before God, but the problem is they were in a society that was fundamentally unjust and unequal. So the question is, how do you operate under those circumstances? So Paul does something nobody else does. We have a lot of these, they're called household rules. Okay. We've got a lot of these from the ancient world, basically instructions on how people are to live in their different relationships. The New Testament ones are the only ones that tell masters that they have obligations to their slaves, to treat them well and all of those sorts of things.
So bottom line is, the New Testament doesn't support or condone slavery. Rather, there are places where Paul mostly simply acknowledges it to be a reality and tells slaves and slave owners what it means to be a follower of Christ in the context of that relationship. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's part of it. That all of the New Testament teachings, supposed teachings on slavery, more or less fall into that category. It's an acknowledgement of the fact that it's there, you are in this relationship, what do you do under these circumstances?
So rather than actually condoning the institution and expressing support that it continue, in this context, sooner or later, as the Christian worldview starts to permeate the culture, then it would seem that even the very idea of slavery starts to lose its charm, I suppose, would be one way to put it. But it gets to the point where if you are a follower of Christ and you are in a position to, say, be in a master relationship with somebody, you're much more likely to look for an opportunity to assist the person or put them to work or whatever that would look like in that context, rather than have them be your slave.
Well, yes, and if you look at the New Testament, let's just stick to the New Testament for the moment. What you find is where you have a specific instance of a slave and master who are both Christians, the text is really very, very clear that the owner, a guy named Philemon, is expected to set his slave Onesimus free. So again, in the one instance where we have a specific situation where there's a specific slave, a specific owner, both of them Christians, the instructions are clear. Set him free. Along with that, we should note that the New Testament, not often but in a few places, has explicit condemnations of slave trade, buying and selling of human beings. That it says that people who engage in this cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. I mean, it is very, very clearly condemned. So it's hard to escape. I mean, if you're going to be fair about it, it's hard to escape the notion that while the New Testament, written in a context in which slavery existed and in which opposition to it could result in a very, very bloody crackdown, more or less accepts the fact that it's there in society and tries to figure out how to regulate it, overall, the attitude towards slavery is really quite negative.
Now, I'm sure someone can come back and push back that there were Christians who supported slavery in the antebellum South that argued for continuing it, were against abolition. But I think it's fair to say that that kind of begs the question. The whole question here is, does the Bible support slavery or doesn't it?
And just because there are Christians who might say it does, that point of view is only as good as the arguments for it. So I think the arguments that we're putting forth here are basically that it didn't. And so on our view, simply put, those people were simply wrong. This isn't a slavery episode, so don't get the whole thing to be about slavery. But the point is, we don't want to get caught up in that. The fact of the matter is, some people are going to get we're going to get some things wrong. But go ahead.
Well, when you actually take a look at the history of the Christian Church, the attitude towards slavery in the American South is an aberration. The fact is that as early as the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas is arguing that slavery is a sin. Slavery virtually disappeared from medieval Europe, except for Muslim prisoners of war who were taken as war reparations. The abolitionists in both Britain and the United States were led by Christians, the abolition movement, and they were making biblical arguments and so on. Yet somehow, despite the overwhelming evidence throughout the history of the Christian tradition of opposition to slavery, somehow people take the people in the American South and use them as typical of what Christianity teaches about slavery. It's completely irrational, and it's historically ignorant to do that, frankly.
A question comes to mind on this is how much were those who were condoning slavery and arguing for its continuation influenced by liberal theology? And we can discuss that question when we come back from the break. Before the break, we were talking about slavery, and how much, I have to wonder how much of the defense of slavery among self-identified Christians in the South before the Civil War might have been influenced by liberal theology, the theology of Schleiermacher and others who basically applied so-called Enlightenment rationalism to theology and Christianity.
That's a good question, because in fact you'll find that a lot of Enlightenment thinkers were pro-slavery. I mean, that does in fact happen. Rather than liberal theology, I think what you see emerging is a concept of race that is really different from what had existed earlier. Originally, the term race meant something like nationality, so people would talk about the difference between the English race and the French race and the Italian race and the German race and so on. In the 19th century, I believe largely in response to the recognition increasingly that slavery is immoral and that there's no real excuse for it, the modern concept of race, or what I would call scientific racism, develops. And that develops as a way of justifying an immoral institution. So now we have three main races, your Caucasians, your Mongoloids, and your Negroids. And the fact is, according to this theory, the Caucasians are the superior race because they grew up in a harsher climate, so they had to be tougher and smarter and everything else. So they are actually superior to the Africans, the Negroids, and as a result, it's actually to the Negroids' benefit that they be brought into contact with this superior culture and race.
So as we've been talking this whole episode about the influence of Christianity on Western civilization, this would be a good example of what happens when that influence starts to wane and alternative worldviews, specifically naturalistic worldviews and evolutionary worldviews, begin to take to have more of an impact on culture. This is some of the problems that can result from that, isn't it?
Well, precisely, and I would point out that as I argued in the book, which is where we started, that this is bringing us right back to Rome. We're once again back to a hierarchical concept of society, with some people being superior and others inferior, and the inferiors can therefore be used for whatever we want to use them for. Same justification for slavery as in Rome.
So it looks like now, and I'm trying to tie this into your book, nowadays the new superior race is the race of people called victims. So if you can find some way to identify yourself a victim of oppression, whether it be racial, whether it's gender-based, whether it's sexuality-based, you now have a claim for superiority. Is that too much of a stretch?
Well, not at all, actually. And this comes from a concept that's really at the root of a lot of postmodern political thinking and social thinking, frankly. And it's best described as a zero-sum game. In a zero-sum game, whenever somebody wins, they win because somebody else is losing. Whenever one person is advancing, they're doing it because they are pushing somebody else down. Now, this concept of zero-sum game applies, it's used mostly in economics, but it really, in postmodern thinking, or at least this version of postmodernism, it sort of applies across the board. So if one culture is dominant, it became dominant by oppressing other cultures. If one group within society is dominant, it became dominant by oppressing others, and so on. And along with this, morality or ethics or virtue is also a zero-sum game. By oppressing other people, you lose virtue, but when you lose virtue, it goes to the victim. So by becoming a victim, you gain moral authority because the person who is victimizing you has lost it, and it's a zero-sum game, so it had to go somewhere. It goes to you. That's fundamentally what they're thinking.
And so on this thinking, the one with the virtue is the superior one, and it becomes acceptable to deny basically humanity to the alleged oppressor, to the one with the less virtue. At least that's the way it seems.
Well, yeah, I think that that's exactly right. This is why this particular political postmodernism, it crosses party lines, it crosses left to right, but it is in many ways really dominant in the left. They're the ones who most explicitly run with these ideas. And it's no accident that it is the left that sort of systematically attempts to silence the right. They shut down rallies, they shut down speakers on college campuses and so on by claiming that they're being victimized or in some cases literally by physical action, physical violence, preventing people from attending and so on. It's because they've got the moral status to do this, and that person who is going to say things that offend them has no moral status and therefore no right.
Now, while this episode was supposed to be about your book, if somebody wanted to read more about these political theories and where they come from, what would you point them to?
Well, I'll point them to a different book, actually. It's a shorter one I wrote called Portals, subtitled Entering Your Neighbor's World. It's a worldview catalog. It's got seven different worldviews in it, including a discussion of this particular version of postmodernism. It's a real brief read, but it's a good intro.
And they could find that on Amazon?
Absolutely.
So look for the link in the show notes, if I ever post actually show notes with this. So getting back to your book with 2 minutes left to go in the show. So we talked at length about slavery, and this basically became a really long rabbit trail into slavery. But it's an important issue because it's human rights is foundational to where we are and who we are. And that's really what your book is all about, is how we came to think the way we do and why we, and basically I would argue it's a good defense of why we ought to continue to think that way. If you don't have rights as a human being, then you really have nothing. And it's a frightening existence knowing that your life, your day-to-day ability to exist and do what you need to do is at somebody else's whim. Where do you think we're headed now?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? I don't have a crystal ball. I'm a historian. I look in the past, not into the future. But having said that, if current trends continue, I think what we're looking at for a variety of different reasons is certainly a collapse of American culture and economics, but also a complete revaluation of the entire Western tradition, including issues of human rights.
All right, well, we're going to have you back for another episode to try to tie all this up. So that's all the time we have for today. So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to talking to Glenn again. Thanks for joining us.